Chapter 7. The man-making forces of the modern state. So far we have concerned ourselves with the introductory and foundation matter of the new Republican project, with the measures and methods that may be resorted to. Firstly, if we would raise the general quality of the children out of whom we have to make the next generation, and secondly, if we would replace divergent dialects and partial and confused expression by a uniform, ample and thorough knowledge of English throughout the English-speaking world. These two things are necessary preliminaries to the complete attainment of the more essential nucleus in the new Republican idea. So much has been discussed. This essential nucleus, thus stripped, reveals itself as the systematic direction of the molding forces that play upon the developing citizen, towards his improvement, with a view to a new generation of individuals, a new social state, at a higher level than that at which we live today, a new generation which will apply the greater power, ampler knowledge and more definite will our endeavors will give it, to raise its successor still higher in the scale of life. Or we may put the thing in another, and more concrete and vivid way. On the one hand, imagine an average little child, let us say in its second year. We have discussed all that can be done to secure that this average little child shall be well born, well fed, well cared for, and we will imagine all that can be done has been done. Accordingly, we have a sturdy, beautiful, healthy little creature to go upon, just beginning to walk, just beginning to clutch at things with its hands, to reach out to and apprehend things with its eyes, with its ears, with the hopeful commencement of speech. We want to arrange matters so that this little being shall develop into its best possible adult form. That is our remaining problem. Is our contemporary average citizen the best that could have been made out of the vague extensive possibilities that resided in him when he was a child of two? It has been shown already that in height and weight he, demonstrably, is not, and it has been suggested, I hope almost as convincingly, that in that complex apparatus of acquisition and expression, language, he is also needlessly deficient. And even upon this defective foundation, it is submitted, he still fails, morally, mentally, socially, aesthetically, to be as much as he might be. As much as he might be, is far too ironically mild. The average citizen of our great state today is, I would respectfully submit, scarcely more than a dirty cloud about his own buried talents. I do not say he might not be infinitely worse, but can anyone believe that, given better conditions, he might not have been infinitely better? Is it necessary to argue for a thing so obvious to all clear-sighted men? Is it necessary, even if it were possible, that I should borrow the mantle of Mr. George Gissing, or the force of Mr. Arthur Morrison, and set myself in cold blood, to measure the enormous defect of myself and my fellows by the standards of a remote perfection, to gauge the extent of this complex muddle of artificial and avoidable shortcomings through which we struggle? Must one, indeed, pass in review once more bucolic stupidity, commercial cunning, urban vulgarity, religious hypocrisy, political claptrap, and all the raw disorder of our incipient civilization before the point will be conceded? What benefit is there in any such revision? Rather, it may overwhelm us with the magnitude of what we seek to do. Let us not dwell on it, on all the average civilized man still fails to achieve. Admit his imperfection, and for the rest let us keep steadfastly before us that fair, alluring and reasonable conception of all that, even now, the average man might be. Yet one is tempted by the effective contrast to put against that clean and beautiful child some vivid presentation of the average thing, to sketch in a few simple lines the mean and graceless creature of our modern life, his ill-made clothes, his clumsy, half-fearful, half-brutal bearing, his coarse defective speech, his dreary unintelligent work, his shabby, impossible, bathless, artless, comfortless home. One is provoked to suggest him in some phase of typical activity, enjoying himself on a bank holiday, or rejoicing, p. peacock feather in hand, hat askew, and voice completely gone, on some occasion of public festivity on the defeat of a numerically inferior enemy, for example, or the decision of some great international issue at baseball or cricket. This, one would say, we have made out of that, and so point the new republic in question. Cannot we do better? But the thing has been done so often without ever the breath of a remedy. Our business is with remedies. We mean to do better, we live to do better, and with no more than a glance at our present failures we will set ourselves to that. To do better we must begin with a careful analysis of the process of this man's making, of the great complex of circumstances which mold the vague possibilities of the average child into the reality of the citizen of the modern state. We may begin upon this complex most hopefully, by picking out a few of the conspicuous and typical elements and using them as a basis for an exhaustive classification. To begin with, of course, there is the home. For our present purpose it will be convenient to use home as a general expression for that limited group of human beings who share the board and lodging of the growing imperial citizen, and whose personalities are in constant, close contact with his until he reaches 15 or 16. Typically, the chief figures of this group are mother, brothers and sisters, and father, to which are often added nursemaid, governess, and other servants. Beyond these are playmates again. Beyond these acquaintances figure. Home has indeed nowadays, in our world, no very definite boundaries, no such boundaries as it has, for example, on the veldt. In the case of a growing number of English upper middle class children, moreover, and of the children of a growing element in the life of the eastern United States, the home functions are delegated in a very large degree to the preparatory school. It is a distinction that needs to be emphasized, that many so-called schools are really homes, often very excellent homes, with which schools, often very inefficient schools, are united. All this we must lump together. It is, indeed, woven together almost inextricably when we speak of home as a formative factor. The home, so far as its hygienic conditions go, we have already dealt with, and we have dealt too, with the great neglected necessity, the absolute necessity, if our peoples are to keep together, of making and keeping the language of the home uniform throughout our worldwide community. Purely intellectual development beyond the matter of language we may leave for a space. There remains the distinctive mental and moral function of the home, the determination by precept, example, and implication of the cardinal habits of the developing citizen, his general demeanor, his fundamental beliefs about all the common and essential things of life. This group of people, who constitute the home, will be in constant reaction upon him. If as a whole they bear themselves with grace and serenity, say and do kindly things, control rage, and occupy themselves constantly, they will do much to impose these qualities upon the newcomer. If they quarrel one with another, behave coarsely and spitefully, loiter and lounge abundantly, these things will also stamp the child. A raging father, a scared deceitful mother, vulgarly acting, vulgarly thinking friends, all leave an almost indelible impress. Precept may play a part in the home, but it is a small part, unless it is endorsed by conduct. What these people do, on the whole, believe in and act upon, the child will tend to believe in and act upon. What they believe, but do not act upon, the child will acquire also as a non-operative belief. Their practices, habits, and prejudices will be enormously prepotent in his life. If, for example, the parent talks constantly of the contemptible dirtiness of boors and foreigners, and of the extreme beauty of cleanliness, and even obviously rarely washes, the child will grow to the same professions and the same practical denial. This home circle it is that will describe what, in modified Herbartian phraseology, one may call the child's initial circle of thought. It is a circle many things will subsequently enlarge and modify, but of which they have the centering at least, and the establishment of the radial trends, almost beyond redemption. The effect of home influence, indeed, constitutes with most of us a sort of secondary heredity, interweaving with, and sometimes almost indistinguishable from, the real unalterable primary heredity, a moral shaping by suggestion, example, and influence, that is a sort of spiritual parallel to physical procreation. It is not simply personalities that are operative in the home influence. There is also the implications of the various relations between one member of the home circle and another. I am inclined to think that the social conceptions, for example, that are accepted in a child's home world are very rarely shaken in afterlife. People who have been brought up in households where there is an organized underworld of servants are incurably different in their social outlook from those who have passed a servantless childhood. They never quite emancipate themselves from the conception of an essential class difference, of a class of beings inferior to themselves. They may theorize about equality, but theory is not belief. They will do 100 things to servants that between equals would be, for various reasons, impossible. The English woman and the anglicized American woman of the more pretentious classes honestly regards a servant as physically, morally, and intellectually different from herself, capable of things that would be incredibly arduous to a lady, capable of things that would be incredibly disgraceful, under obligations of conduct no lady observes, incapable of the refinement to which every lady pretends. It is one of the most amazing aspects of contemporary life to converse with some smart, affected, profoundly uneducated, flirtatious woman about her housemaid's followers. There is such an identity, there is such an abyss. But at present, that contrast is not our concern. Our concern at present is with the fact that the social constitution of the home almost invariably shapes the fundamental social conceptions for life, just as its average temperament shapes manners and bearing, and its moral tone begets moral predisposition. If the average sensual man of our civilization is noisy and undignified in his bearing, disposed to insult and despise those he believes to be his social inferiors, competitive and disobliging to his equals, abject, servile, and dishonest to those he regards as his betters, if his wife is a silly, shallow, gossiping spendthrift, unfit to rear the children she occasionally bears, perpetually snubbing social inferiors and perpetually cringing to social superiors, it is probable that we have to blame the home, not particularly any specific class of homes, but our general home atmosphere, for the great part of these characteristics. If we would make the average man of the coming years gentler in manner, more deliberate in judgment, steadier in purpose, upright, considerate, and free, we must look first to the possibility of improving the tone and quality of the average home. Now the substance and constitution of the home, the relations and order of its various members, have been, and are, traditional. But it is a tradition that has always been capable of modification in each generation. In the unlettered untraveling past, the factor of tradition was altogether dominant. Sons and daughters married and set up homes, morally, intellectually, economically, like those of their parents. Over great areas homogeneous traditions held, and it needed wars and conquests, or it needed missionaries and persecutors and conflicts, or it needed many generations of intercourse and filtration before a new tradition could replace or graft itself upon the old. But in the past 100 years or so, the home conditions of the children of our English-speaking population have shown a disposition to break from tradition under influences that are increasing, and to become much more heterogeneous than were any home conditions before. The ways in which these modifications of the old home tradition have arisen will indicate the means and methods by which further modifications may be expected and attempted in the future. Modification has come to the average home tradition through two distinct, though no doubt finally interdependent, channels. The first of these channels is the channel of changing economic necessities, Using the phrase to cover everything from domestic conveniences at the one extreme to the financial foundation of the home at the other, and the next is the influx of new systems of thought, of feeling, and of interpretation about the general issues of life. There are in Great Britain three main interdependent systems of home tradition undergoing modification and readjustment. They date from the days before mechanism and science began their revolutionary intervention in human affairs, and they derive from the three main classes of the old aristocratic, agricultural, and trading state, namely, the aristocratic, the middle, and the labor class. There are local, there are even racial modifications, there are minor classes and subspecies, but the rough triple classification will serve. In America, the dominant home tradition is that of the transplanted English middle class. The English aristocratic tradition has flourished and faded in the southern states. The British servile and peasant tradition has never found any growth in America, and has, in the persons of the Irish chiefly, been imported in an imperfect condition, only to fade. The various home traditions of the 19th century immigrants have either, if widely different, succumbed, or if not very different, assimilated themselves to the ruling tradition. The most marked non-British influence has been the intermixture of Teutonic Protestantism. In both countries now the old home traditions have been and are being adjusted to, and modified by the new classes, with new relationships and new necessities, that the revolution in industrial organization and domestic conveniences has created. The interplay of old tradition and new necessities becomes at times very curious. Consider, for example, the home influences of the child of a shopman in a large store, or those of the child of a skilled operative and engineer of some sort, let us say in England. Both these are new types in the English social body. The former derives from the old middle class, the class that was shopkeeping in the towns and farming in the country, the class of the Puritans, the Quakers, the first manufacturers, the class whose mentally active members become the dissenters, the old liberals, and the original New Englanders. The growth of large businesses has raised a portion of this class to the position of Sir John Blundell Maple, Sir Thomas Lipton, the intimate friend of our king, and our brewer peers. It has raised a rather more numerous section to the red plush glories of wagon-lit trains, and their social and domestic equivalents, and it has reduced the bulk of the class to the status of employees for life. But the tradition, that our English shopman is in the same class as his master, that he has been apprentice and improver, and is now assistant, with a view to presently being a master himself, still throws its glamour over his life and his home, and his child's upbringing. They belong to the middle class, the black coat and silk hat class, and the silk hat crowns the adolescence of their boys as inevitably as the toga made men in ancient Rome. Their house is built, not for convenience primarily, but to realize whatever convenience is possible after the rigid traditional requirements have been met. It is the extreme and final reduction of the plan of a better class house, and the very type of its owner. As one sees it in the London suburbs devoted to clerks and shopmen, it stands back a yard or so from the road, with a gate and a railing, and a patch, perhaps 2 feet wide, of gravel between its front and the pavement. This is the last pathetic vestige of the preliminary privacies of its original type, the gates, the drive-up, the front lawn, the shady trees, that gave a great impressive margin to the door. The door has a knocker with an appeal to realities, ring also, and it opens into a narrow passage, perhaps 4 feet wide, which still retains the title of hall. Oak staining on the woodwork and marbled paper accentuate the lordly memory. People of this class would rather die than live in a house with a front door, even added a draft-stopping inner door, that gave upon the street. Instead of an ample kitchen in which meals can be taken, and one other room in which the rest of life goes on, these two covering the house site, the social distinction from the servant invades the house space first, by necessitating a passage to a side door, and secondly by cutting up the interior into a dining room and a drawing room. Economy of fuel throughout the winter and economy of the best furniture always keeps the family in the dining room pretty constantly, but there you have the drawing room as a concrete fact. Though the drawing room is inevitable, the family will manage without a bathroom well enough. They may, or they may not, occasionally wash all over. There are probably not 50 books in the house, but a daily paper comes and Tidbits or Persons Weekly, or, perhaps, M.A.P. Modern Society, or some such illuminant of the upper circles, and a cheap fashion paper, appear at irregular intervals to supplement this literature. The wife lives to realize the ideal of the 80-like lady she resigns to the patrician, and she insists upon a servant, however small. This poor wretch of a servant, often a mere child of 14 or 15, lives by herself in a minute kitchen, and sleeps in a fireless attic. To escape vulgar associates, the children of the house avoid the elementary schools, the schools called in America public schools, where there are trained, efficient teachers, good apparatus, and an atmosphere of industry, and go to one of those wretched dens of disorderly imposture, a middle-class school, where an absolute failure to train or educate, is seasoned with religious cant, lessons in piano playing, lessons in French, aid in England, mortarboard caps for the boys, and a high social tone. And to emphasize the fact of its social position, this bookless, bathless family tips. The plumber touches his hat for a tip, the man who moves the furniture, the butcher boy at Christmas, the dustman, these things also, the respect and the tip, at their minimum dimensions. Everything is at its minimum dimensions. It is the last chipped, dwarfed, enfeebled state of a tradition that has, in its time, played a fine part in the world. This much of honor still clings to it. It will endure no tip, no charity, no upper class control of its privacy. This is the sort of home in which the minds of thousands of young Englishmen and Englishwomen receive their first indelible impressions. Can one expect them to escape the contagion of its cramped pretentiousness, its stingy narrowness, its shy privacy of social degradation, its essential sordidness and inefficiency? Our skilled operative, on the other hand, will pocket his tip. He is on the other side of the boundary. He presents a rising element coming from the servile mass. Probably his net income equals or exceeds the shopman's, but there is no servant, no black coat and silk hat, no middle class school in his scheme of things. He calls the shopman sir, and makes no struggle against his native accent. In his heart he despises the middle class, the mean tip givers, and he is inclined to overrate the gentry or big tippers. He is much more sociable, much noisier, relatively shameless, more intelligent, more capable, less restrained. He is rising against his tradition, and almost against his will. The serf still bulks large in him. The whole trend of circumstances to substitute science for mere rote skill in him, to demand initiative, and an intelligent self-adaptation to new discoveries and new methods, to make him a professional man, and a job and peace worker after the fashion of the great majority of professional men. Against all these things the serf element in him fights. He resists education, and clings to apprenticeship. He fights for time work, he obstructs new inventions, he clings to the ideal of short hours, high pay, shirk and let the master worry. His wife is a far more actual creature than the clerks. She does the house herself in a rough, effectual fashion. His children get far more food for mind and body, and far less restraint. You can tell the age of the skilled operative within a decade by the quantity of books in his home. The younger he is, the more numerous these are likely to be. and the younger he is, the more likely he is to be alive to certain general views about his rights and his place in the social scale, the less readily will his finger go to his cap at the sight of broadcloth, or his hand to the proffered half-crown. He will have listened to trade union organizers and socialist speakers. He will have read the special papers of his class. The whole of this home is, in comparison with the shopman's, wide open to new influences. The children go to a board school, and very probably afterwards to evening classes or music halls. Here again is a new type of home, in which the English of 1920 are being made in thousands, and which is forced a little way up the intellectual and moral scale every year, a little further from its original conception of labor, dependence, irresponsibility, and servility. Compare, again, the home conditions of the child of a well-connected British shareholder in Reading, let us say, 700 or 800 a year, with the home of exactly the same sort of person deriving from the middle class. On the one hand, one will find the old aristocratic British tradition in an instructively distorted state. All the assumptions of an essential lordliness remain and none of the duties. All the pride is there still, but it is cramped, querulous, and undignified. That lordliness is so ample, that for even a small family the income I have named will be no more than biting poverty, there will be a pervading quality of struggle in this home to avoid work, to frame arrangements, to discover cheap, loyal servants of the old type, to discover 6% investments without risk, to interest influential connections, in the prospects of the children. The tradition of the ruling class, which sees in the public service a pension scheme for poor relations, will glow with all the colors of hope. Great sacrifices will be made to get the boys to public schools, where they can revive and expand the family connections. They will look forward as a matter of course to positions and appointments, for the want of which men of gifts and capacity from other social strata will break their hearts, and they will fill these coveted places with a languid, discontented incapacity. Great difficulty will be experienced in finding schools for the girls from which the offspring of tradesmen are excluded. Vulgarity has to be jealously anticipated. In a period when smartness, as distinguished from vulgarity, is becoming an ideal, this demands at times extremely subtle discrimination. The art of credit will be developed to a high level. Now in the other family economically indistinguishable from this, a family with 700 or 800 a year from investments, which derives from the middle class, the tradition is one that, in spite of the essential irresponsibility of the economic position, will urge this family towards exertion as a duty. As a rule, the resultant lies in the direction of pleasant, not too arduous exertion. The arts are attacked with great earnestness of intention. Literature, movements of many sorts, are ingredients in these homes. Many things that are imperative to the aristocratic home are regarded as needless, and in their place appear other things that the aristocrat would despise: books, instruction, travel in incorrect parts of the world, games, that most seductive development of modern life, played to the pitch of distinction. Into both these homes comes literature, comes the press, comes the talk of alien minds, comes the observation of things without, sometimes reinforcing the tradition, sometimes insidiously glossing upon it or undermining it, sometimes letting daylight through it, but much more into the latter type than into the former. And slowly the two fundamentally identical things tend to assimilate their superficial difference, to homologize their traditions. Each generation sees a relaxation of the aristocratic prohibitions. A gentleman may tout for wines nowadays among gentlemen. He may be a journalist, a fashionable artist, a schoolmaster. His sisters may see tea, while, on the other hand, each generation of the ex-commercial shareholder reaches out more earnestly towards refinement, towards tone and quality, towards etiquette, and away from what is common in life. So in these typical cases, one follows the strands of tradition into the new conditions, the new homes of our modern state. In America, one finds exactly the same new elements shaped by quite parallel economic developments. Shopmen in a large store, skilled operatives, and independent shareholders developing homes, not out of a triple strand of tradition, but out of the predominant home tradition of an emancipated middle class, and in a widely different atmosphere of thought and suggestion. As a consequence, one finds, I am told, a skilled operative already with no eye or only an angry eye, four tips, sociable shopmen, and shareholding families, frankly common, frankly intelligent, frankly hedonistic, or only with the most naive and superficial imitation of the haughty incapacity, the mean pride, the parasitic lordliness of the just independent, well-connected English. These rough indications of four social types will illustrate the quality of our proposition, that home influence in the making of men resolves itself into an interplay of one substantial and two modifying elements, namely 1. Tradition 2. Economic conditions 3. New ideas, suggestions, interpretations, changes in the general atmosphere of thought in which a man lives, and which he mentally breathes. The net sum of which three factors becomes the tradition for the next generation. Both the modifying elements admit of control. How the economic conditions of homes may be controlled to accomplish new republican ends has already been discussed with a view to a hygienic minimum, and obviously the same, or similar, methods may be employed to secure less materialistic benefits. You can make a people dirty by denying them water, you can make a people cleaner, by cheapening and enforcing bathrooms. Man is indeed so spiritual a being, that he will turn every materialistic development you force upon him into spiritual growth. You can aerate his house, not only with air, but with ideas. Build, cheapen, render alluring a simpler, more spacious type of house for the clerk, fill it with labor-saving conveniences, and leave no excuse, and no spare corners for the slavey, and the slavey and all that she means in mental and moral consequence will vanish out of being. You will beat tradition. Make it easy for trade unions to press for shorter hours of work, but make it difficult for them to obstruct the arrival of labor-saving appliances. Put the means of education easily within the reach of every workman. Make promotion from the ranks, in the army, in the navy, in all business concerns, practicable and natural, and the lingering discoloration of the serf taint will vanish from the workman's mind. The days of mystic individualism have passed. Few people nowadays will agree to that strange creed, that we must deal with economic conditions, as though they were inflexible laws. Economic conditions are made, and compact of the human will, and by tariffs, by trade regulation and organization, fresh strands of will may be woven into the complex. The thing may be extraordinarily intricate and difficult, abounding in unknown possibilities and unsuspected dangers, but that is a plea for science, and not for despair. Controllable, too, is the influx of modifying suggestions into our homes, however vast and subtle the enterprise may seem. But here we touch for the first time a question that we shall now continue to touch upon at other points, until at last we shall clear it and display it as the necessarily central question of the whole matter of man-making so far as the human will is concerned, and that is the preservation and expansion of the body of human thought and imagination, of which all conscious human will and act is but the imperfect expression and realization, of which all human institutions and contrivances, from the steam engine to the plowed field, and from the blue pill to the printing press, are no more than the imperfect symbols, the rude mnemonics and memoranda. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.